Welcome to another podcast at SlysOffice.com, brought to you by our friends at the Axley Law Firm. Joining us today, Mike Riley. He is a personal injury lawyer. If you've been injured in a motorcycle or car accident or due to someone's negligence, he or John Walsh would be an excellent choice over at the Axley Law Firm. Mike, what's your phone number there?
608-257-5661.
All right. Now, I've always been accused of being too sympathetic to the police. You take a slightly different view on when police should shoot and when they shouldn't. This Anand Swaminathan, hopefully I'm pronouncing his name right. He was one of the attorneys that collected on these $7 million in verdicts for this family, the DiPiazza family, where Madison police a few years ago shot and killed a woman who had a gun to her head. Your thoughts about what he wrote and that situation and the verdict?
Well, I have a number of thoughts on it. First of all, I should also say that my friend Jeff Scott Olson was one of the lawyers, and Jeff Scott Olson is about is thoroughly decent an attorney or person as you could find. He's taken on a lot of really, really tough causes where there's not much return, and hopefully he'll be rewarded for this one because he deserves it. He's taken on a lot of civil rights kinds of issues, a lot of individual rights, and again, you don't collect. This is really anomalous. To get this kind of verdict is something that happens once in a career if you're very lucky, and so that's I was pleased for him. I think, you know, I'm also not sure whether they've collected on the verdict. This is federal court. Federal court judges are, especially in this district over the years, have been fairly notorious for reducing verdicts. Now, whether they'll do it here or not, they may well not. And I don't even know, honestly, if they've gotten to that stage. My assumption is they probably haven't. There's always the potential for an appeal as well, I suppose, to the Seventh Circuit. So, but all that said, I think this is pretty much fact-driven, which makes the courts, make the Seventh Circuit a lot less likely to do anything with this verdict if the insurance company for the city chose to appeal. What just befuddles me, Sly, is why they would choose to try this case. As you say, you and I have somewhat different views. I don't know that they're starkly different. I think, you know, you feel, look, my wife, we were watching Crash. Remember Crash?
That movie? Excellent movie.
Good movie. Mm-hmm. It really was. Really just a fine movie. And my wife, who's like myself, has been appalled with some of these shootings. And watching the movie, and I think the part where Matt Dillon crawls into the burning car to rescue the woman who he's earlier behaved inappropriately with, said, boy, that really is a hard job. And I think that's something you and I both agree on completely.
We had an officer in Indiana the other day who climbed into a car to rescue someone in a car that had rolled over and got shot to death.
Yeah, and that I hadn't read that, but that's appalling. There are real risks to the job, and it does require decision making that can be difficult and can require you to make split-second decisions. Problems I have more generally are I think the training is completely inappropriate, needs to be redone. I've known Mike Koval since he was a kid, and I respect him. I think he's a very decent man and a very bright man, and he's done a lot of the training. But I think their training is following kind of the national pattern, which really seems to be, first of all, you know, if when in doubt, shoot. And that really is concerning to me, that the officers are being trained to place their own safety in ahead of the public's, which I don't think is appropriate. I don't think officers should needlessly have to risk their lives, but I do think that you can't simply skew that equation to the point where the officers are more concerned about their own well-being than the well-being of the citizens who they are supposed to protect and serve.
All right, now this is an interesting case in that the police retreated, but then this woman came out again, and it appears as though the real dispute is whether she was moving towards the officers or not. Now, some say the forensic evidence shows she was not moving towards the police officers when she had the gun to her head. Jim Palmer from the Wisconsin Professional Police Association said that really case study shows that when someone has a gun to their head, they are very capable of, they're not only very capable, but in some cases likely from changing from a position of wanting to harm themselves to harming an officer.
Yeah, and I don't agree with him at all. And I'm sorry, he's an apologist for the police. That's his job. I was going to say respect. I don't know that I do respect that. I respect people who tell the truth. Look, I've handled firearms. I've fired firearms. You know, I did it in the military. I've done it since then. If you've got a woman with a gun to her head, they've got their guns drawn and pointed. This is not a matter of whether they should have pulled their guns from the holster to begin with. They had them out. They had them pointed at this woman. If you can't shoot that, one, I can shoot that woman in the shoulder and hit her 50 times out of 50 at that distance. It's just not difficult for anyone with any training at all. And if you can't do that, you shouldn't be on our police department, or at least you shouldn't be given a weapon.
All right, but doesn't that go to how they were trained? Because they're going to say that we're right.
I agree with you completely, and that's why I think that's a fundamental part of the problem. Is I don't think. And the second part is, we talked about, whose safety comes first. But the second part is, they've now been trained that if you're going to use force, you're going to fire your gun, then you basically empty it, and you empty it with intent to kill. And I don't agree with that either. That's situational. If somebody's coming at you with a weapon, you're coming at you with a knife from a few feet away, coming at you, comes out with their gun pointed, I have no problem with that at all. Although this shooting her 11 times strikes me as really suspect under those circumstances. And the officer's testimony, the part I read, and I didn't sit through the trial, I don't know all the testimony, but, the officer basically seemed to suggest that they had panicked and just kept pulling the trigger, which certainly wasn't helpful to the defense. And it also doesn't speak very well for their training, quite honestly, if that's what happened, because that just shouldn't happen. I know that, look, anybody can call in and say, I'm all wet. You've never been there. You never stood there with somebody. That's absolutely true. But I've represented police officers, and I've represented people who were shot. And, I do understand the dynamics of the situation. And I think that's why training is critical, because when you're just like in the military, when you get to that situation, you're going to react based on your training, just as you said. And if that training is defective in any way, then your response isn't going to be what, in my mind, it should be. In this case, he's saying that if that woman she's got her gun raised and pointed at her head, she's got to turn with the gun and bring it down at the officers. They're standing there, two officers with drawn guns. If they can't shoot her in that time again, then they shouldn't be on the department at all. That I just don't accept that. I don't know who did the studies. You can skew studies any way you want. You and I both know that. And I just, I don't buy that. I don't think that's true. I mean, I've handled guns a lot. I know what it takes to squeeze the trigger. I know there's a reaction time. I get all that. It just isn't enough to suggest that just because she's got standing there with a gun, she represents, an immediate threat of deadly force.
Now, let me ask you this. Couldn't this have been suicide by cop, though, in that they had told her to put the firearm down numerous times? In both encounters with her, she obviously failed to obey those commands. By the way, the only time I've ever heard of someone getting away with that is Grace Slick from the Jefferson Airplane, who held a gun on the San Francisco police and somehow lived.
Well, San Francisco is even more liberal than Madison. Yeah, so it's different world.
Well, and it was Grace Slick.
It is a little shocking in good old Madison. I mean, it just, could it have been suicide by cop? Yeah, I mean, it may have been, but you know what? If it's really suicide by cop, then she should have come out with the gun aimed at them, because then you're going to get shot. I don't think if she really had wanted to die, she would have shot herself. She could have done it real easily. And again, if she really wanted the cops to shoot her, she could have provoked that easily. I mean, this woman had attempted suicide before. She hadn't gone through with it. I don't think you can say that she would have here. Obviously, the jury didn't believe that, or they wouldn't have given the folks $7 million. And the fact that they gave that kind of money tells you that they were very angry with the police, and they felt that the police had behaved inappropriately. I mean, if they thought, they could have done better, they wouldn't have given her $7 million. I mean, they thought that the police conduct was shameful, and that's why you saw that kind of verdict. And we can talk about in my mind, and again, I wasn't involved in negotiations. I don't know what offers there were, proposals, but I will say this. They had just finished settling two cases, including quite recently the Tony Robbins case, where they paid, 2.6? Why you would ever, after that case, settling that case, choose to go to trial in this case, where the facts were far worse for the police. I mean, that case, you had a young man who was apparently high on mushrooms, had attacked other people, based on the officer's statement, was, you know, the officer perceived a threat. And in that case, I think the officer's perception of a threat was reasonable, whether, you know, he could have done better, maybe he could have. But, I mean, I think that one would have been much easier to defend. This case, when it happened initially, I thought, what in heaven's name are you folks doing? I mean, how do you justify that? And going to trial, in that situation where the papers have just been full of the fact that you paid a whole lot of money in a case to a young man who, you know, was in a far less sympathetic position, basically, than this woman was, taking that case to trial was folly in my mind.
Attorney Covelli said that the woman had expressed anger at the officers. And here's a quote. I don't know if this is from Palmer. Suicidal subjects can become homicidal subjects to force a confrontation, he said. The almost universal view, and studies support this, is that an officer's reaction time is slower than the time it takes for a person to move the gun from his head and fire it.
Yeah, I don't believe that. I mean, I'd want to know who ran the studies, because, you know, my guess is it's, you know, more police organizations who've run the studies to justify what they do. And, you know, I'm all too used as a lawyer to seeing studies that are concocted by people who are trying to defend their position. And I haven't seen the studies. He didn't reference which studies. If I, you know, somebody wants to send them to me, I'll look at them. But the bottom line is, you know, witnesses who get up and defend, there are a series of witnesses who get up and testify for police officers. A lot of them are hired guns, in this case, a very appropriate phrase. And, you know, what they're saying, what they know they need to say to get to justify the officer's conduct. I don't think these officers are bad people, so I'm not saying they're murderers. I'm not saying they deliberately. I think, you know, certainly a combination of training and perhaps the officers' personalities, but whatever the reason, in my view, these officers panicked and they behaved inappropriately. They exposed the city to huge liability, which, you know, it ultimately redounds on the taxpayers. I know the insurance company will pay it, but after what we've gone through in this city over the last few years, the rates for the city are going to skyrocket if you're going to be paying out this kind of money on these claims on a regular basis. So I think from every possible, first and foremost because of citizen safety, but for the officers' well-being and certainly for the fiscal well-being of the city, changes have to be made. This can't just go on, and we can't have somebody as like and admire as much as Mike Koval saying, well, that's fine, they acted according to their training. Well, if they did, then there's a real problem with their training.
And we will have Mike Koval on next week to respond to all this.
Mike knows me real well, and he probably won't be happy to hear any of it. I like Mike, and I respect him, and I think he's a very good person. But I really differ with him on the notion that somehow this specific event is consistent with what officers should do based on their training.
All right, we'll take a break. Talk more with Mike Riley from the Axley Law Firm at slysoffice.com. Summer is usually a great time for food choices for people in Wisconsin. Backyard gardens, farmers markets, grocery stores brimming with fresh produce. But for a lot of people, they don't have those choices because school is not in session. A lot of kids get their nutrition during the school year, so we need your help. St. Vincent de Paul has a food pantry that gives your neighbor in need some of the same choices you have. But to keep it going, we need your help, your donations, support the food pantry. And you can do one of a couple things. Drop off an extra bag of groceries from the store or your local farmer's market. Also, a $50 cash donation feeds a family of five for a week. You can organize a food drive, whatever it takes to keep that food pantry going this summer while the kids are at home. Let's do what we can. Here's what you do. You contact St. Vincent de Paul at svdpmadison.org. That's svdpmadison.org. Let's work on this together. We're back with Mike Riley at slysoffice.com. Mike Riley, personal injury lawyer with the Axley Law Firm. Mike, recently the president spoke to some law enforcement officers on Long Island, and earlier in the day had talked to some immigration police, or obviously customs police, something like that. Anyway, here's the remarks the president made to police in New York.
When you see these thugs being thrown into the back of a paddy wagon, you just see them thrown in, rough. I said, please don't be too nice. Like when you guys put somebody in the car and you're protecting their head, you know, the way you put their hand over. Like, don't hit their head and they've just killed somebody, don't hit their head. I said, you can take the hand away, okay?
Now, the president's press secretary said, in fact, that the president was joking.
Yeah, I think the second part is a joke. I mean, I think when he, you know, the head thing is, you know, that's fairly trivial. But, you know, he talks about throwing him into the back of the paddy wagon. And in light of the fact that not so long ago we had that happen and a man died as a consequence of at least how he was, you know, how he was let in and kept in the paddy wagon and the driving that went on. I don't see much humor in that. And, you know, I think it's, as a general matter, you know, I'm not crazy about hearing police laugh about that stuff. Do I understand it? Sure. Do I think that's a horrible thing? No, I don't think it's a horrible thing. But, you know, these are serious matters. I mean, I've seen police arrest people. I've seen police handle people. I've seen it done well. We've all seen plenty of it done badly now, you know, because of all the videos that are available. And again, I mean, look, they handle some difficult people. And there are situations where you have to use a significant amount of force, you know, to subdue someone to ensure that they're not going to threaten the police or someone else. I get that. But I think it's all too easy to go over the line from there to something else. I had a police officer some years ago. I was down seeing a client at the jail, and this particular officer was somebody who should never have been on the sheriff's department. He was an embarrassment. And he had a bad reputation. And they put him in the jail to keep him away from the citizens, really, because that's the kind of guy he was. And he decided that he was going to come out, and he was not happy with the fact that I was insisting on seeing my client, which I had every right to do. And he came out and was going to manhandle me. Well, you know, I'm an old hockey player, and, you know, I'm an Irishman. I'll take well to that. And the next thing he knew, he was up against the wall with my, you know, forearm around across his throat. Well, God knows, in these days, maybe they'd shot me. But he didn't have a gun, fortunately. But, you know, that's what that triggers. I mean, if you treat people with respect, there are always exceptions. But if you treat people with respect and don't manhandle them and don't use more force than is necessary, most citizens, not all, but most citizens, you know, are going to comply, are going to do the right thing. If you treat people like that, you're going to get the kind of response he got from me. And like I said, if we'd been out in the street somewhere and people had guns, who knows, you know? I was a white lawyer, so they probably would have been less likely to shoot me. But, you know, the whole notion that, you know, police should use as much force as they can. No, they should use as little force as they can. And I think most good officers do that. But for the president of the United States to suggest that you ought to be roughing these people up, you know, most of the people they're putting in the paddy wagon are not murderers and rapists, although, you know, the president doesn't seem to know the difference between, you know, someone who's committed a fairly minor crime and, you know, that sort of conduct. And the notion that you just treat everybody alike is nonsense. If you have to use that degree of force, well, then you have to use it. But it shouldn't be what you start with. And I think that's what his remarks seem to encourage.
This week we discovered that some police in Baltimore allegedly planted drugs on a suspect. And what they didn't know is that evidently when you turn these body cams on, they actually start recording 30 seconds before they're manually turned on. So it probably means that they're always on, but they, when they're flipped on to an on mode, they start using more energy and are recording. Oh, so in fact, the district attorney in the city of Baltimore, the city of Baltimore is its own county. Baltimore County is a separate county, but for the city of Baltimore, has now taken all the cases where these officers' word was involved as opposed to any physical evidence and thrown all of them out. And yet, in the Freddie Gray case, which she, you know, obviously brought those officers to trial and none of them were convicted, in the St. Paul suburb case, in the Milwaukee case, which I actually thought was a pretty weak case, but the certainly the case in Minnesota where the officer shot the custodian, I'm going to have to agree with you on that one, that that case was outrageous. But again, a jury didn't bring a conviction. Juries don't seem to be in a big hurry to convict police officers criminally.
No, you're right. And I think there are several reasons for that. One, it is a tough profession and they are at risk. And I think they get sympathy because of that. And they deserve some consideration for that, certainly. The other thing is the instructions in the criminal cases are just outrageous. I mean, our U.S. Supreme Court years ago, it isn't this, I blame this current court for an awful lot, but I can't blame them for that. Years ago, the U.S. Supreme Court basically came down with this standard that says, well, if there's any reasonable belief that, you know, da-da-da-da-da. And it really becomes kind of subjective, even though it's supposed to be an objective standard, is what would a reasonable police officer under those circumstances do? I think juries basically make it very subjective. And if this guy says, look, I really believe that I was in danger, that seems to be enough for them. And I think the instruction encourages that. And until we change the law in a way that you know, really places the same responsibility on police officers we place on everyone else, which is to behave in a fashion that a normal person would behave under those circumstances, you know, I think you're going to continue to see this. And I don't think some of the cases that have been publicized so heavily, you know, help. The case in St. Louis that they've kind of made the poster child for these cases was a terrible case to use for people like myself who believe the police should be held accountable when they act irresponsibly. I mean, that young man, with all due respect, he's dead. He shouldn't be. That's too bad. He was a thug. I mean, his behavior was thuggish. And I know that's offensive to some people. I'm sorry. Based on everything I saw there, it's true. And that officer, I don't think, behaved very well. I doubt he was very well trained. He didn't strike me as somebody, you know, who probably had what you should have to be a police officer necessarily. But the fact remained, based on the facts that we have and what we've seen, you know, he's being confronted by a fairly large, angry man who he found to be threatening. And I think that case is a lot more defensible than many of the others.
And yet, because
and I think
of
that's
the,
in people's minds.
And yet, because of the actions of the Ferguson police over the last 10 years, or probably more than that, it put that officer in a very precarious situation because, frankly, the force was not a very compatible with the population and was not treating the majority of the population, the people in Ferguson, with any dignity and respect. But what I've noticed is that, like everything, politics has become nationalized. Suddenly the Madison police were viewed like the Ferguson police, and there are a lot of people that retrench to the police officer side automatically, and there are a lot of people that retrench to whoever is either the suspect or the victim in these shootings. And there is an inability on either side to walk in another person's shoes. They make a decision on this automatically. I mean, this Brandy Grayson convicted Officer Kenny seconds after the shooting and you know, was in front of the cameras saying that he was guilty of murder. It's very hard to have any type of solution in dealing with these problems when people are so retrenched to their sides.
Oh, you're right, Sly. And I agree completely. I thought that reaction was absolutely unjustified. I mean, I can understand it. Look, you know, you lose a child. I get that. But, you know, this days of rage over that. I mean, where was the outrage at his friends who gave him the mushrooms? You know, where was that outrage? I mean, in my view, they're the ones that killed him.
Mike, it may not have been the friends that gave him the mushrooms, but I don't want to get myself in inner jeopardy, but it may have been someone even closer.
Well, whoever it was, and I mean, you know, I don't know, but whoever gave it to him, I mean, they're certainly complicit in his death. That's what triggered the chain of events that ultimately led to his death. Let's face it, his own behavior. Nobody made him take mushrooms. I don't think anybody slipped it in his drink, from what I heard. And, you know, he went out and attacked people and did things. The people that friends themselves, as I understand it, called the police because of his behavior. So you put the policeman in a difficult situation. You know, whether he did the best that could be done, that's not the test. The question is, you know, is never, did you do the best anyone could possibly have done? Or, you know, was there a better choice to make? Because the answer in those situations is very often, yes, there was. The question is, did he behave as a reasonable police officer might under those circumstances? And I think given that question in that case, I don't think you'd have ever convicted him criminally, and I don't think he should have been convicted criminally.
And yet the defense attorney who wrote this op-ed piece is saying, look, the police are taking license from district attorneys not charging someone criminally by not punishing officers when they make mistakes, when they're not necessarily criminal mistakes, but they may be either procedural or reckless.
Yeah, but that's not the DA's job. I mean,
No. And he's not saying it's the DA. You're right. But his remarks, this Anand Swaminathan, I really do hope I'm pronouncing that properly. He's saying the internal review police process is giving a rubber stamp to police conduct.
I think that's fair in a lot of cases. I think that's probably a little too strong because I'm sure there are cases. But I will say this. I think where there's any doubt at all, they come down on the officer's side. And again, part of the problem, Sly, is if the officer can say, look, here's how we were trained, then how can you, as a police department, how can you discipline him if, in fact, he's doing what he was trained to do? Then you get back to the fundamental problem that I don't believe they're being properly trained. I really believe that the training procedures both here and nationally need to be reviewed, because I don't think there's any ill will there. And I think that people like Mike Koval, who did a lot of the training, Mike Koval is a good person. And I firmly believe that Mike does what he believes is the right thing. Now, you know, he's a police chief and has been a police officer for years. Are his sympathies going to tend to lie with, the policeman? Probably. But he also is the guy that they used to call Kumbaya, Koval, because he didn't want to work with the community. I know he still does. I think he really does make an effort to reach out to the community. I think the way that some members of our council have treated him and the police department is disgraceful and unjustified. I have sympathy for where they stand, and I understand why his sympathies and a lot of officer sympathies are going to lie with the officer who is doing a difficult job. But that doesn't justify, a lot of what we've seen and a lot of what we've seen. We've seen shootings I can understand. We've seen plenty that I don't. I just don't see how you just the child who was shot in Cleveland by an officer who hops out of the car and opens fire on him. That was inexcusable, and that person should be in jail, but he's not. I think the one in Minnesota probably will go to jail, in part at least because he shot right across his own partner, which is insane and certainly isn't consistent with the way they're trained. But there are just way too many of these shootings that are not justified. But you know what, Sly, I would also, before we finish the topic, I would also like to see similar outrage within the black community at all the shootings of young black men by young black men. And I'd love to see that addressed. And I know there have been some efforts in Madison. And I'm not talking about conciliation after the fact or comforting the victims who, God knows, need it. But, I'd like to see something done to try to prevent this and try to curtail this. We're already at a record for our city for the year, and it looks like it's going nowhere but up.
When you have 6-year-old boys getting shot in the backyard of their grandma's house as they're going to tell grandma they're going fishing, as happened on the north side of Milwaukee, something seriously wrong.
Well, it's appalling, and let's face it, that's part of the whole picture, too. If you were a police officer in Madison 25, 30 years ago when we had a murder about every 5 years, and there were very few guns on the streets relative to today, your response to things is going to be different. I mean, let's face it. Now you're picking up the paper and reading about this. I have a client, one of my clients who's a police officer, great guy, worked on their tactical squad and now is in their intelligence department. And, he said, Mike, we have gunfire every night. They've got this device on top of the city county building that can localize it. And, he said, we get reports of gunshots or we can see them on the thing. We go out. There are shell casings, there are bullet mark potholes, and we talk to the people and nope, never heard anything, never saw anything. No one, even the people who are in the building that's got the shell marks on it. do I understand that? Yeah, people are afraid. A lot of this is gang and people are afraid of getting involved, but if the community that's most directly involved and is most directly harmed by this, which is the black community, let's face it, that's the reality. The police need their help. They don't need this nonsense from Black Lives Matter. The police is an occupying force, and they just need to get out of the neighborhood. In some of these cases, if they just got out of the neighborhood, I think you really would have chaos. We need people to work with the police. That requires the police to treat the community decently, but it also requires that the community, you know, accept the police, work with the police to curtail conduct that, that hurts their community terribly.
Mike Riley from the Axley Law Firm. Thanks for coming to sliceoffice.com.
Thanks, like
Mike. Mike, what's your phone number once again?
608-257-5661.
All right. Thank you, Mike.
Sliceoffice.com.
Thanks a million.
Bye-bye.
Making stuff matters, because when we make things in America, America makes it. American workers and families make it. Our communities make it. Consider this. For every one manufacturing job in our communities, five more jobs are supported. Manufacturing jobs pay an average of 10 to 50% more than service sector jobs. That allows working families to support their local businesses, schools, emergency services, and more. Creating 2.5 million new manufacturing jobs would mean at least $100 billion for our economy over the next decade. Domestic manufacturing is the green economy. It's among the cleanest, most efficient, and productive in the world. That's why the United Steelworkers and our more than 1 million members and retirees are fighting so hard to protect and grow manufacturing. Because making stuff really does matter. Join our fight. Visit usw.org and like us at facebook.com/steelworkers. Support American manufacturing. Buy American. Buy Union.